Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. For millennia, Europeans believed the world had three parts: Europe, Africa, Asia. In 1507, two obscure German scholars put a fourth part on the map and called it America. The story of that map turns out to be the story of human comprehension of the universe, a mind bender, a game changer. This hour, On Point, the story of the map that gave America its name. You can join the conversation. Can you imagine when humans really did not know what was across the water? What do we not know now? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later in this hour, we'll hear from a cosmic physicist about the next realm of discovery and how our sense of the universe could be overthrown again. But first, joining us from Washington is Toby Lester, writer and contributing editor at The Atlantic. His new book, and it's really great, is The Fourth Part of the World, The Race to the Ends of the Earth, and the Epic Story of the Map that Gave America Its Name. Toby Lester, welcome to On Point.
Thanks, Tom. It's great to be here.
This is some story. I didn't quite know how much seafaring and intellectual acrobatics, religion, you name it. It's all bound up in here, and it all goes back to a map. Introduce us to the map as we speak today, Toby. Where's the map?
There's only one surviving copy of the map, and the Library of Congress owns it. The library bought it in 2003 for $10 million. It's a big deal. And they bought it because of the name America, of course. They've often called it, as have others, the birth certificate of America. And anybody can go see it in the Jefferson Building of the Library of Congress
this
now.
Is the, it's called the Waldseemüller map.
That's right.
Drawn or printed in 1507. I mean, the one that they've got, the last of the 1,000, and it's huge, right? It's large.
It's 8 feet by 4.5 feet. It's actually 12 separate sheets assembled together to create a single map of the world. And we're told that there were 1,000 copies printed. It's a little hard to know that for sure, but only one seems to have survived.
As far as we know, this is the first map on which you can see a continent in the west of the map, Eurocentric map, of course, but in the west, surrounded by water and labeled America.
That's right. The makers of this map actually were the ones who coined the name America. It wasn't just that they put the name on the map first. It's that they decided to come up with that name. They knew well about Columbus. It wasn't that they were ignoring what Columbus had done, but they decided that Amerigo Vespucci deserved the honor.
We'll talk about exactly why that is. The maps, it seems 999 of them totally went missing. They all went missing. It was about a century ago that a scholar dug this one out of a German castle.
That's right. It's almost a fairy tale kind of story. The map disappeared for several hundred years, and people thought it was lost. There was a lot of hunting for it that was done in the 19th century, and it became a kind of quest for the Holy Grail among cartographic historians and historians of the Age of Discovery. And then, as usually happens, by accident, a Jesuit priest named Joseph Fischer happened to be in a minor castle in the south of Germany looking for something else, and he stumbled across this map.
Now, I'm looking at a copy of it here from the book, and much of it looks very familiar. You know, Africa, Europe, they look very well drawn. You can see India here. You can see a kind of distended Asia out there. This new continent, America, doesn't look... I mean, you can kind of see where they're going, but it's really distorted compared to what we know now. Why is the name America on here instead of Columbus? Why isn't it called Columbia?
Well, you have to back up a little bit. Again, we start out with the idea that the world at the time of Columbus and prior, of course, was generally divided up into three parts. It was the known world, Europe, Asia, and Africa. And Columbus, until his dying day, never believed that he'd done anything other than reach Asia. That was the whole point of his enterprise, was to sail, find an ocean shortcut to the Far East where he could bring back the gold and the spices that everybody had been talking about and importing into Europe for quite a while.
And his dying day was right around the time of this map's publication.
1506,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
So Columbus, in a way, we like to think that Columbus in 1492, as soon as he sailed across the Atlantic, kind of blew everybody's minds and introduced the new world to Europeans, at least. But in fact, he believed that what he'd done was confirm what was already on the map. You know, here is Asia as everybody has described it, and I've found a new way to get there.
So it wasn't a new world, just a new way to a place that people had talked about and Marco Polo and others had traveled to for a long time.
Precisely, yeah. And it wasn't until others, especially Amerigo Vespucci, began describing how far to the south the New World extended. So it's a kind of shift of the way we think about this. It's not so much the westness of this discovery that was making an impression on people in these early years. It was the southness. Vespucci sailed to the islands of the Caribbean and the northern part of South America, just like Columbus did. But then on one famous voyage, right at the turn of the 15th to 16th century, he sailed thousands and thousands of miles south, well below the equator, and realized that he was following a coast that didn't appear on any map that had ever been made. Most geographers at that time speculated that in that part of the globe, there could only be water. Vespucci described this coast that he discovered, sent it in a letter back to Europe that got printed and sent widely around the countries of Europe, and people began to talk about Vespucci as much more of a celebrity discoverer than Columbus.
Now, introduce us a little bit to him. I think a lot of people just think of him as some kind of map maker or didn't know who he was, but this was a real sailor out of Florence who really put some long miles under his belt on the high seas way out there where Europeans had never been.
That's right. It's not entirely clear whether he was a real sailor or not. Some of his letters make him out to be, but others have sort of determined that he may have been a bit of a self-promoter. It's a little hard to say just because the letters themselves aren't clear, and the letters may have been doctored and kind of puffed up for sensational purposes.
You mean we don't
printers.
Know whether he sailed the Atlantic or not?
No, we do know that he sailed the Atlantic, mm-hmm. but the question is whether he was a sailor and in command, making the decisions about where to go and how mm-hmm. to sail, or whether he was just a passenger. By origins, he was a merchant from Florence. He drifted over to Spain and Portugal like a lot of Italians did at the in the early days of the Age of Discovery because there was a lot of money to be made there. And somehow or another got himself on at least two, possibly more, transatlantic voyages. And what he saw he then described in letters home to Florence. And then the brand new printing industry sort of took over. It's not entirely clear who took his letters, probably adapted them, added some cannibalism and some sex, and realized that they could sell these things pretty quickly. And in sort of the 1503 to 1505 period, you get a lot of his letters appearing all over Europe.
And just look at his name and the name that we now have, America, and why that worked. What did it mean? There's a little bit of old Greek in here as well.
That's right. If you want, I can read the actual passage that Martin Waldseemüller and his co-worker, mm-hmm. Matthias Ringmann,
yes, please.
Wrote in a book called The Introduction to Cosmography, which describes how they derived the name America. It's an almost forgotten passage, but it just lays it out for everybody to hear.
Mm-hmm.
They wrote this little book as a companion volume to this big map. It's called The Introduction to Cosmography. Most of the book is a kind of plotting summary of what the cosmos looks like, how you can do astronomy and geometry and figure out various principles of mapping. At the end of the book, they talk about the three known parts of the world, Asia, Africa, and Europe. But then they make this odd kind of personal announcement right in the middle of this otherwise kind of dry textbook, and I'll read it.
Mm-hmm.
These parts, they say, referring back to Europe, Asia, and Africa, have in fact now been more widely explored. And a fourth part has been discovered by Amerigo Vespucci. Since both Asia and Africa received their name from women, I do not see why anyone should rightly prevent this new part from being called Amerigen, the land of Amerigo, as it were, or America after its discoverer, Americus, a man of perceptive character.
And there it is, the authors themselves, as they put the name on the map in 1507. There were Greek roots so that you could sort of play with this as a pun. It could also mean in Greek, ancient Greek.
Right. Well, what they're doing is they're taking the word Amerigo and putting it in a different case in Greek and making it Amerigen, which can then be broken up into land of America, which they say themselves here, land of Amerigo, mm-hmm. as it were. They're referring to the Greek pun that they're making. But then they're taking that and they're Latinizing it because they're writing in Latin.
Yes.
So they're taking Amerigen and turning it into the Latin version of that Greek word. which then comes out, as we know it now, America. But they're also feminizing it because the other continents had the names of women.
But if you take the pun, it could mean born new or no place land.
Right. Right. The particularly Matthias Ringmann, the one who probably actually wrote this book, was a kind of a very playful literary type who loved to pun and to do other kinds of word games. And you can quite easily break down this word, Amerigen, into a word that means born new, which of course has all sorts of perfect symbolic resonances as Europeans began to make their way into the New World. And especially the classical scholars and the humanists at the time really did look at the New World as a place where people might be returning to a sort of new age of glorious, lost ancient civilization. And then there's also the possibility that it can be broken up into a word that means no place land, which in turn seems to have been something that Sir Thomas More was echoing when he invented the word utopia, which of course referred to another newly discovered island out in the ocean that had all sorts of interesting possibilities as well.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the map and man and time that gave America its name, at least to those who had never visited, those who did not live there already. Toby Lester is with us. He is author of the new book, The Fourth Part of the World, The Race to the Ends of the Earth and the Epic Story of the Map that Gave America its Name. And I should say, by the way, you can read an excerpt and see a really cool interactive version of the map via our website, onpointradio.org. Toby Lester joins us from Washington. And Toby, a lot of people weighing in already. Here's a on the web, our website, from Barbara, saying this seems to be an Eurocentric and imperial perspective. The people who lived on this continent knew it existed. They didn't need maps. Maps seem to be an agent of imperialism. If we can map it, we can own it. Toby Lester, you basically say, yes, indeed, that was in no small part the attitude of the time.
That's absolutely the attitude of the time, and that's part of the point of this book. Mm-hmm. In writing the book, I tried to write it with the map itself as the guide to the book. The map itself is literally Eurocentric. Europe appears kind of in the middle of the map. And, of course, that means that your view of the rest of the world is slightly distorted. And that has, you know, great symbolic meanings as well. The story I'm telling in this book is how Europeans in particular gradually not just discovered the New World for themselves, but also other parts of the world, Africa, Asia, all as a part of this kind of growing idea that they could, in a specifically Christian context, gradually sort of gain dominion over the entire globe, not just the three parts of the known world, but whatever else there might be. I'm not at all trying to say that this is, you know, some sort of absolute naming of America and other parts of the world that deny the existence of the others. But the people who were making the discoveries and the people who were then interpreting those discoveries and making maps in Europe really were not particularly sensitive to the native peoples who were encountering the discoverers.
And their insight, their understanding, and their ambition grew right along with these maps. But I'm interested, early on in the book, you've got a piece from Isidore of Seville that goes back to, I don't know, maybe nearly 1,000 years before this map came out, and writing that the Earth is placed in the central region of the cosmos. We'll come to that and how Copernicus sort of overturned that with some inspiration from this map. Standing fast in the center, equidistant from all other parts, the old cosmology. He wrote in, this is 600, it's divided into three parts, one of which is called Asia, the second Europe, the third Africa. And then, apart from these three parts of the world, there exists a fourth part beyond the ocean, which is unknown to us. Now, that was maybe 900 years before Columbus sailed. What's the source of that understanding?
Well, Isidore Seville was a sort of a compiler of previous authorities' descriptions of just about everything. It's not just geography that he ends up talking about. But in this case, he's sort of recounting ideas that were current in ancient Greece and ancient Rome. there were lots of speculations that there were lands beyond the known world. The Greeks, of course, had Atlantis, the myth of a giant continent somewhere out there in the ocean. There was plenty of anecdotal evidence from ancient times that there was something out there. You know, all sorts of things would drift up after storms across the Atlantic onto the islands of the Atlantic and African coastline. So there was plenty of theorizing and evidence that something was out there, but nobody really knew. There are lots of maps in the Middle Ages that speculate about the existence of land beyond the known world. Usually the speculation comes in the context of it being inaccessible. It's out there. We can't know about it. Maybe it's even another sort of second inhabited world like the known world of Europe, Asia, and Africa, but it's people on the other side of the globe, and maybe we're never even going to get to see them.
The Spaniards were none too happy with the fact that it was called America instead of something after Columbus, and even colonial and later independent Americans wrote sort of disparagingly about the names, like Washington Irving and Ralph Waldo Emerson. What was their problem with the America name?
Well, they were all picking up on what had originally come out of Spain, and this was the idea that somehow Vespucci himself had been responsible for this naming. He wasn't. He probably never even knew about it. But an idea emerged in the sort of the middle of the 16th century that Vespucci had deliberately presented himself as more of an explorer than he was, and in fact had claimed to be the first to discover continental land in South America. There's a probably spurious letter of Vespucci's that describes arriving on the shores of South America in 1497. Columbus didn't do that until 1498. That would give Vespucci, you know, sort of naming rights, if you want to talk about it from the European context.
You've got Emerson saying America must wear the name of a thief because it's called.
That's right. Yeah, no, there are wonderful quotes. And it's kind of like an echo chamber as you go down the centuries. People, on the one hand, falling into the Columbus camp and disparaging Vespucci in very, very creative ways, all sort of following the line that Vespucci had somehow engineered that this map be made and the continent be named in honor of him.
Not so.
On the other hand, you get people who are just singing Vespucci's praises as a genuine discoverer who has sort of changed history for all time. Both are really not right.
Let's get a call from Dell in Wellesley, Massachusetts. Dell, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi. I had read the excerpt from Toby's book, and I think it's extremely interesting. I was wondering, though, if either of you have heard of a man called Gavin Menzies. Gavin
sure.
Menzies is a retired Australian naval commander. He was a submarine commander.
Mm.
And over the last 5 or 6 years, he's written a couple of very interesting books. And he addressed this question of maps which were available in Europe prior to Columbus, which purported to show parts of the world that were unknown to Europe. Now, the Waldseemüller map came out in 1507.
Mm-hmm.
That was before Magellan. And there is a quote that Magellan had said before he set on his voyages, "How did you know to go around South America?" And he said he had seen a map in the library of the King of Portugal, not the Waldseemüller map, presumably another map. And what Gavin Menzies has suggested is that the Chinese in the early 15th century, about the 1420s or so, had a great navigator called Zheng He, who had a huge fleet of hundreds of ships. Some of the ships were enormous ships. They were multiple times the size of Columbus's ships, for instance. And they did, it is well documented, they did voyage through the Indian Ocean and the eastern coast of Africa. There is even a map that is in Europe, I think it's in Istanbul, which shows the coast, both coasts of Africa, with an inscription on the top that says that an Oriental or Asian ship crossed the Cape of Good Hope.
Dell, let us look at that. It's a great point, and I want to hear Toby Lester's response, and also Toby, just the explanation that comes out for how in 1507 they could be showing this continent with water on the other side when we're all famously told it wasn't until 1513 in the eyes that looked across the Isthmus of Panama that Europeans knew the Pacific was there.
Sure, Gavin Menzies' theories are very popular these days. His books have done very well. They start out with a undeniable fact of history that there were these great fleets that sailed through the Indian Ocean and reached the east coast of Africa. Beyond that, it becomes very, very speculative, and just about all of the historians of cartography and discovery who've kind of examined Menzies' claims thinks he really is kind of stretching a little beyond credulity. There are, though, plenty of maps that exist prior to the Portuguese circumnavigation of Africa that show Africa having a southern tip, that reflect knowledge of the southern tip of the continent. A lot of that would come from Muslim merchants who were sailing in the Indian Ocean. There is this very famous map, the Fra Mauro map, that makes that remark about an Oriental ship sailing around the south of the continent. It's hard to know exactly what it's talking about, and it's I think, dangerous to spin theories out that then take you across the Atlantic with a fleet of Chinese ships that then visit the Caribbean, and then circumnavigate Greenland, that go all the way around South America, and then up to San Francisco and across to Russia. The evidence is very, very thin.
But what's your theory, then, of how, you know, Balboa 1513, looking across Panama, seeing the Pacific, we've all heard that story. How did these guys have a map with the Pacific in there in 1507?
It's impossible to say, and everybody can make guesses. One guess would be that it is nothing more than a guess. They knew the size of the globe pretty well. They knew the available land that the known world consisted of. If what they were seeing on sailors' charts, especially in the south, didn't correspond to what was already on the maps, they may have just decided that this must be something different, just when you look at the distances involved. The sailors' charts that came back in the early 1500s showed the east coasts of North and South America and then left the west sides undefined.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, by nature, when you're doing something on a map, you have to draw a line somewhere. They drew lines. So what you look at on the sailors' charts, if you're not fully aware of what you're looking at, looks like it might be surrounded by water. So it may be that they just sort of assumed that that was the case. It's also possible that they had access to information about secret Portuguese voyages around the southern tip of South America. That's, you know, it's...
it's kind of cloak and dagger
element
here.
But it's possible.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's amazing. Just amazing to see how all this unfolded. And we'll come to Copernicus. Jeff's calling. Hi, Jeff. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I find this a really fascinating topic. I often wonder what are the things that we don't know now that people 1,000 years from now are going to be talking about on Point, of course,
yeah.
1,000 years from now. You know, like for instance, people are still dying every day from cancer, and 1,000 years from now, someone may be making a comment like, you know, can you believe our ancestors 1,000 years ago actually died from this disease that we consider an everyday cure?
Exactly, Jeff, or even closer, you know, maybe something about the shape of our universe or what's across some of those dark heavens that we are ignorant of now and may discover later. You know, if you'll hold that thought, we're actually going to bring in a physicist in the next segment of this conversation to scratch our heads about that very issue of what we may not know now. But Toby Lester, here you write, you know, you really lift your eyes up along with the people of that time from the ocean itself and the map makers' charts to the work of Copernicus and their very understanding of the shape of the universe itself. And there's an intersection here between this map and the work of Copernicus reshaping ultimately humankind's understanding of the cosmos itself. What's the linkage?
It's a slightly speculative one, but I think it's a very suggestive one, and it's well worth delving into. It requires backing up and understanding a little bit about how the cosmos was imagined in the Middle Ages.
They did not think it was a flat. The world was flat, as many people.
No, and that's a myth that just doesn't die. Most medieval Europeans knew full well that the world was round. There are plenty of ways that you can figure that out. If you're a sailor on the ocean, you see ships kind of appearing above, you know, below and then rising up above the
mm-hmm.
horizon.
Mm-hmm.
That's because the Earth is round. So that flat Earth myth just incidentally, it seems to be something that Washington Irving cooked up and really dramatized in a biography that he wrote of Columbus in the 1820s.
But on the other hand, they did not perceive the cosmos as we do now.
Right. The Earth was a sphere fixed, not moving at the center of the cosmos, and it was surrounded by other spheres, the planets, the moon, the sun. Most immediately, though, it was surrounded by the sphere of water. And for a long time, that model was really just sort of not thought out too hard. But in the late Middle Ages, scholars began to say, well, if technically we're surrounded by a sphere of water, then there shouldn't be any land exposed because there's a sphere of water around us, just like there's the sphere of air that envelops the whole Earth. Why is it that there's land anywhere? Then they did all sorts of gyrations and came up with this theory that the Earth was actually, it had, by divine fiat, had been sort of bobbed to the top of one side of the sphere of water, sort of floating like an apple, exposed a little bit on one side. And that helped explain how there could be land exposed to the air and life on Earth at all. And for a while, that seemed to do the job.
But if Copernicus saw this map, and you have reason to believe he may have.
Right. So if you can picture what I've just been describing, you've got a sphere of water with the Earth bulging out of one side. What bulges out there, medieval geographers would have said, is the known world. And if you think of Europe, Asia, and Africa as basically one contiguous large landmass all surrounded by water, the model works pretty well. If you think about that model, though, it means that if the Earth is bulging out on that one side of the globe, there has to only be water on the other side because the other side of the world is deep underwater now. What you see on the Waldseemüller map is that directly opposite, if you stuck a pin through the globe, directly opposite the known world on the other side of the world is this new land that Waldseemüller has just called America.
Which can't be in the old conception. If you're bobbing for apples, only one part of the apple can be above the water.
Right. You can't have land on both sides of the globe. So it seems that Copernicus may have been looking at this map and found evidence for the fact that the kind of standard model of the Earth at the center of the cosmos couldn't hold. Either the world was completely surrounded by the sphere of water, in which case life was impossible, so you have to throw that out. Or it bulged out of one side. Maybe that works, but if you can't then explain how there can be a giant continent on the other side of the globe, you have to scrap that too.
And so very earthly explorers and map makers end up maybe prompting a thinker who put the Earth in orbit, put the sun at the center of our understanding, really sort of opened the gates to our understanding of the universe as we do today.
Yeah, it's. I don't want to oversell the point because Copernicus obviously had a lot of very specific astronomical work he was doing, but he started out his famous book on the subject with geography, and I think there's good reason for it. He wanted to kind of ground his conversation, literally, and begin methodically demolishing the old way of looking at the world, and that comes first of all with this idea that there is a new land called America on the other side of the ocean, and if that land actually exists, as the discoverers and the humanists say it does, then perhaps we have to rethink everything.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the map and man and time that gave America its name and reshaped our understanding of our place ultimately in the universe. Toby Lester is with us. He's author of the new book, The Fourth Part of the World, The Race to the Ends of the Earth and the Epic Story of the Map that Gave America its Name. Let me get a call here first from Hampton, Virginia. And Mike. Mike, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
A couple things crossed my mind when I tuned in. One is that there was a map reputedly from the Middle Ages, if not before, called the Piri Reis map that Columbus or perhaps other sailors in Iberia found or looked at or so forth. It showed the coastline of Antarctica and the southern extremes of the South America and so forth. That's number one. Number two, what about the Templar coastal inroads into New England? Because there are even monuments to dead Templar knights. There are one in particular in Rhode Island, I think, which still stands. So, and they are figuring that the that North America was explored at least in the 11th and 12th century.
Let us pick it up, Mike. And thank you. Toby Lester, to our caller from Hampton, Virginia, what do you say?
Well, on that first map, the Peri Reis map, it's a map that actually dates from 1513, and it seems to be a map that was in the possession of one of the sailors who had sailed with Columbus but then was captured by pirates in some sort of naval encounter in the Mediterranean and fell into Turkish hands. It's interesting because it shows probably how Columbus and his contemporaries were imagining what they were discovering at the time. The rest of the map isn't that unusual, and some maps did speculate about an Antarctic kind of continent, but none of them seems to reflect any special knowledge of parts of the world that hadn't yet been explored by Europeans. As far as the Templars in New England and all of that goes, there are lots of theories out there, and there, of course, there were visits to North America before Columbus by peoples from Northern Europe. Beyond that, it's all so speculative that I don't really have a whole lot to say on the subject.
Toby Lester, stand by if you would. You got us thinking with your very rich treatment of this map from centuries ago and the whole cultural surround, the sense of how a culture is brought into a new understanding of what surrounds it in the world, even in the universe. We wanted to reach out to a physicist today to ask if we could be sitting, you know, blindly on the coast of some new understanding of our universe, even as we talk about Columbus and Amerigo Vespucci and all the rest. Joining us right now from Rehovot, Israel, is Michael Dine. He's professor of physics at the University of California, Santa Cruz. He's author of the book Supersymmetry and String Theory Beyond the Standard Model. Michael Dine, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you. Hello.
Is it possible that we may one day see parallels between future exploration or understanding of our universe and these sort of, world-changing new insights that came in the time of Columbus and Vespucci?
Well, I think it's, of course, hard to anticipate, paradigm shifts, large paradigm shifts,
of course,
by definition. But certainly, I actually think I would back up, and I would say the 20th century certainly saw very dramatic changes in our perception of the universe, of both on all sorts of scales. We understood, physicists and astronomers understood the workings of stars. They understood that the universe is not static, and something about its evolution, so the development of the Big Bang Theory, which in the early part of the century looked somewhat far-fetched, and by the end of the century, is viewed as established fact. So certainly, already in not-so-distant times, that's happened. And I think there are ways you could imagine. There are some indications that there are limitations of our understanding of certainly of the universe and of the laws of nature that could perhaps portend similar kinds of changes.
Like, I don't know if, like what?
Well, there are three that come to mind. One is something called that astronomers call the dark matter. And already in the 1930s, astronomers began to suspect that much of the mass of the universe is in some form that we don't see. And for a long time, that was viewed with some skepticism. It was perhaps thought that maybe there are just stars which are dark, which don't burn, or maybe small planet-like objects. But over the last 20 years or so, this has gone from being suspicion to essentially being established fact. There's now an enormous amount of evidence from a variety of sources that for all the matter we see, the sort of normal stars and the stuff that makes up us, there is probably about five times as much of this unconventional stuff.
That is dark matter, as it's...
Yes, it's so-called dark matter.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't know what it is. The only thing we know about it is its force of gravity, basically. So we know how much it weighs, but we don't know what it is.
Could we come to understand that in a way that was a kind of a comparable shock to the system of understanding our universe as you know, the New World was to Europeans of the 15th century?
Whether it will be a comparable shock is an interesting question. I mean, there are a number of speculations, of course, about what it might be, what this dark matter might be, and there are experiments of a variety of kinds which are searching for it now. So there are labs underground which are trying to isolate what might be the particles of dark matter. The sort of standard picture is that it's some kind of particle, some new sort of elementary particle.
This the Hadron Collider in CERN cranking up or trying to this week.
And the Hadron Collider in CERN something on which I might be said to be placing my bets. It's been in the news. It has had a sort of rocky start.
Yep.
Actually, basically at this moment, it's being shaken down and it's starting up again. So it could well discover this particle, and if it does, it could really give us a lot of detail about what it is and how it interacts.
Toby Lester, we've got the physicist here looking from the present, or even in a way the future, back at the possibility of parallels to the time of Vespucci and Columbus. What about you as a historian looking to where we stand now and forward? Can you imagine that kind of sort of world-rocking, inside opening up again in how we understand the very place we live?
I'm sure it'll happen, but I have no idea what it's going to be, and if I did, I'd be in a different line of work altogether. I will say, though, that something that strikes me as very, very interesting is that pretty much coincident with the making of this 1507 map, we start to get a sort of idea of geography that lasts for about 500 years. You've got this fixed, static picture of the world. You look at the world, everybody kind of is on the same page. North is at the top. Again, we're talking about this Eurocentric perspective.
Mm-hmm.
If you just say the world, everybody has sort of the same idea in mind. That wasn't the case in the Middle Ages. If you said a map of the world to somebody in 1300, there were almost more models of the world than you could imagine. So nobody would have had the same idea in mind. Maps at that time were very interactive, and they often were sort of maps of not only geography but also history. They're sort of time and space tied in together. And, of course, that's where we've come today now, is to think of the universe as a kind of a web of time and space, and you can't isolate one or the other. With the advent of something like Google Maps, too, you don't have this idea that everybody has to look at the same picture of the world to get the geographical information that they need. So there's a kind of interesting fragmenting going on again in directions that in some ways were being pursued in the Middle Ages.
Mm-hmm. Michael Dine, I wonder, this may be too simple a question, but when you think of future discoveries that may be made about the nature of the universe, I mean, do they fall in the category at all of geography, or is it all about sort of the internal workings, the invisible physics? Do you know what I mean? Might this be a matter of maps and geography, cosmography even, or something much more subtle than that?
I think they could well fall into this. First of all, of course, again, Einstein's realization, and Einstein and his colleagues, and especially, of course, Edwin Hubble's actual discovery that the universe is expanding, while it's not, doesn't impact our day-to-day lives in the same way that, the maps of the 16th century do. It certainly has altered our picture of our place in the universe, and I think in a way that affects the thinking of a large fraction of the people on this planet. As a physicist, I'm often asked questions like, "Well, what came before the Big Bang?" And I usually try and back people up and say, and first of all, just talk about how much evidence there is for our emergence from sort of some cosmic explosion 15 billion years ago.
Mm.
But the question of before is certainly a very interesting one, and it's one that's even hard to define within the ideas we have, our understanding of the Einstein's equations and things of this sort. But there are ideas that people are considering that could eventually enlarge our our understanding in that sort of way. You know, whether that would have the impact on our on our thinking, I don't know since we don't really have a good idea what the answer to those sorts of questions might be.
We don't know until we know, and then it can be an earthquake. Let's get a call right here from Rob. Rob, you're on the air with Toby Lester and Michael Dine in Rehovot, Israel, where I could swear I hear goats in the background, unless that's dark matter, Michael.
I think it's a No, I'm afraid it's just a little buzz on this phone.
Okay. Rob.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, Rob.
First time, long time. I read a book recently called The Poincaré Conjecture, and it was a story following a Russian mathematician, I believe, who figured out the shape of the universe. And how does that kind of pertain to, you know, what we've been talking about?
Yeah,
before, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Toby Lester is writing about an understanding in the 15th, 16th, 17th century of the shape of the sort of immediate universe. Michael Dine, presumably now it's a much bigger conversation in terms of scale.
Yeah, certainly a bigger conversation in terms of scale. Certainly a question. I'm actually not too expert on the Poincaré conjecture, but it's not some. The issue there was more an understanding of issues in geometry, but geometry in a sense that's larger than Copernicus or Galileo, say, would have conceived, and which does enter in our current in the things we currently understand and the things we would like to understand about, say, the universe on very large scales. So, when I say large scales, as I said, the universe we know this explosion occurred about 15 billion years ago. We know, remarkably, we have a good deal of information down to just the very first 3 minutes and even beyond that. And so a lot of the questions we have are sort of going even beyond that. And a lot of these kinds of questions about what the geometry might be like are part of it. But it could well be that geometry isn't really, as one would say, too 20th century, that's too Einstein. It may not be geometry that's really the important idea, and we just don't know right now.
If I could jump in, Toby. Just for a second.
Yes, please, Toby.
This has been making me think of that initial quote that you read describing the three parts of the world, but then Isidore of Seville also saying that there exists a fourth part across the ocean that's unknown to us.
Mm-hmm.
And it's easy to read that as a sort of statement of fact and a statement of knowledge, but in a way, I think what he was doing there was reminding everybody that whatever we think we know, namely, in this context, the three parts of the world, there's always more that we don't know, and it's across the ocean, it's sort of inaccessible, it's hard for us to reach, what I think even Waldseemüller and Ringmann would have said is that now we've discovered this fourth part of the world, but we still don't know everything, and this map, in a way, is a reminder of all of the possibilities of human learning and knowledge synthesized, pulled together into a single picture of the world. But it's a sort of, it goads us on to try to learn more, but also to be humble in doing that and remember that there will always be these cosmic questions that we can never resolve.
You've paid a lot of attention to these map makers, obscure Germans from centuries ago. Can you imagine Waldseemüller and Ringmann sort of sitting, over the shoulder of Michael Dine and physicists today, sort of peering on out? They were looking toward what we now call South America and a new, a new continent. Can you imagine them sitting engaged in our sort of elastic understanding of the cosmos today?
I think they would have had a hard time imagining even sitting next to Copernicus. They didn't think that they were upsetting any kind of cosmic order in this mapping of the world. And they died in the early 1500s and wouldn't have really had any word that what they had shown on their map might have led to any different understanding of the cosmos. There's one famous remark that Waldseemüller makes on a later map where he says the machine of the world is what it is, meaning that machine of all these spheres turning around and around the Earth. So it's pretty hard to picture that. Except that they were humanists in the early sense of the word, which meant that they felt that they were all collectively working on gathering information about everything and trying to know more. And that's the spirit of inquiry that they embarked on is the one that everybody's still working with today.
And here we are in the machine of the world with physicists like Michael Dine still figuring it out. Perhaps it is what it is, but we may yet know only a little glimpse of it. Michael Dine with the University of California, Santa Cruz, joining us today from Rehovot, Israel. Thank you very much, Professor Dine, for being
Thank
here.
Thank you. I enjoyed this.
And Toby Lester, author of the fourth part of the world, The Race to the Ends of the Earth and the Epic Story of the Map That Gave America Its Name. Wonderful read, wonderful insights you've pulled out of the story of this great map, Toby. We thank you for your time today. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much.
Listeners, see an interactive version of the map at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.